Is it possible to die beautifully and to write beautifully about the experience? Andrew Solomon joins us to talk about his review of five new books about life, love, and death.
I'm living more in reality than I have been, and I'm going to do a better job of loving because of the love that's in these books.
How do you tell a character's story through the rooms she's lived in? Alexander Fuller will be here to talk about Olga Grushin's new novel, 40 Rooms.
There's plenty of room for the reader to get in there and wrestle with, well, what are the rooms of my life? And I found myself thinking, you know, the greenhouse.
Alexander Alter will give us an update from the literary world. John Williams will be here to share some Valentine's book recommendations from our readers and listeners. And Greg Coles has bestseller news. This is Inside the New York Times Book Review. I'm Pamela Paul. Andrew Solomon joins us now. Andrew did the heroic feat of reading through five books about love and primarily death. I will go through the titles, but first, Andrew, thank you for being here.
What a pleasure.
The books are Death's Summer Coat, What the History of Death and Dying Can Tell Us About Life and Living by Brandi Chalais, The Good Death, An Exploration of Dying in America by Anne Neumann, In the Slender Margin, The Intimate Strangeness of Death and Dying by Eve Joseph, The Iceberg by Marianne Coutts, and When Breath Becomes Air by Paul Kalanithi. This was not a cheerful assignment.
You know, when I got it, I thought, I can't do this. It's going to be too sad. And then I thought, I have to do it. It's going to be deeply real. It was a struggle reading the books and writing about them. There were days when I thought, I just can't bear to do this today. But it was also utterly, utterly absorbing and in many ways the most exciting experience I've ever had as a reviewer.
Why?
Because I felt that they were books that delved so unbelievably deeply into difficult territory and forced me to think about things I might not otherwise have been thinking about. They don't confirm pre-existing prejudices. Taken as a group, they challenge one's vision of the value of health and survival and the horror of death, and make you think that while I myself would like to remain healthy and to survive for a long time, that a lot of the time the deepest experience there is the one of losing your own life and feeling it seep away from you, and that in failing to reckon with that, we narrow our experience terribly.
And almost that the experience of death, or the experience of dying, rather, is curiously enriching and deepening, and if only one could live after going through that.
You know, I felt especially with The Iceberg and When Breath Becomes Air that in both instances I was reading chronicles of people whose lives had become so immensely rich in the experience of dying. And it reminded me of the greatest loss I've dealt with, which was the death of my mother, and the sense that if through some strange miracle it were possible to save people who were at the very brink of death, that the knowledge they would come back with from that experience, not the knowledge of near-death experiences in which someone saw a long hallway and a heavenly host, but the experience of humanity and the experience of what life itself means and is about, would be so invaluable. Now, these are books about people who died, and so we don't get that. But we have a sense in some way that the dance arrived at its apotheosis, at its very ending.
As a reader, you know, you note that most books are by dead authors, and we don't actively mourn Tolstoy, you know, when we read Anna Karenina. But I felt, and I think you probably did too, with the Paul Kalanithi, it's that this tragedy of you just sort of get to know this person and then actively miss them when you're reading the book, when you finish the book.
In a way, if one wants to talk Tolstoy, it was more like the death of Ivan Ilyich. It was the sense that what is so powerful in the book is precisely the clarity that is coming with this dying, and that there is a great intimacy in it, that Paul Kalanithi opens himself up and Marianne Coutts opens herself up in this unbelievable vulnerability that could happen only in that moment of dying. And with the Paul Kalanithi book, you feel like, I'll bet I would have liked this guy anyway.
Right.
But now, watching him go through this transformation, I want to embrace him and I want to turn to him for further wisdom on everything else that might ever happen to him or to me or to the world. And you feel him slipping away. You feel him disappearing. You know, people often say about grand opera that one of the things that's ridiculous about it is that you have these heroes and heroines who are about to die and they sing extraordinary arias for 20 minutes before they drop dead on stage. And you think that's so unlike life. And then you read these books and you think, actually, sometimes that is so like life. And in the same way that you will go and see a great piece of theater and feel agony at the person's dying, you feel agony at this. I feel as though I should have been at the funeral. I feel as though I wish I'd been there to help. I have that real sense that these are such real people and they've been through things that were so excruciating and they're such impressive, moving, wonderful people in some way, and I wish I'd been there, and I wish I could be there now.
The Paul Kalanithi, at least, is, you know, already a huge bestseller. It's number one on our bestseller list, and it's interesting to contemplate what it is that draws a person to want to read about that, to want to go through that experience. I mean, do you think that we are longing to try to find some kind of meaning? Is it about trying to sort of get ahead of it, to understand it, so that somehow we can be prepared?
You know, many books deal with a form of human drama that we mostly won't have to face. You mentioned Tolstoy earlier. Most of us are not going to have to be generals in great wars like the Napoleonic War. We don't live that part of War and Peace. You know, most of us, even if we're in some level of denial, recognize that we're going to die. And with the right to die conversation that's been taking place, especially since that matter in Oregon, with the sense that we're constantly looking at what technologies exist to extend life, with people's fear of hospitals and so on, I think people go through waves of thinking, I don't need to think about this, and then waves of thinking, if I don't think about this, I won't be able to end with nobility. And while the Paul Kalanithi book is really in many ways a description of himself and of his own dying, it's also in some sense an instruction manual for dying with an enormous amount of dignity and for dying the right way. And that's wisdom people used to get from religious texts, and many people have turned away from those religious texts in one way or another. I also think that part of what's compelling about these books is that the enormous beauty that's in them constitutes a form of hope. So on the one hand, the people die. And on the other hand, the people live so richly in that instant before they die. And when you read these books, not only do you have to reconcile yourself to your own mortality, you also think, maybe I can do that as beautifully as they did. And if I can, maybe it won't be so bad for me, for the people I leave behind. Maybe the death of someone else won't be so bad for me. There's a sort of strange comfort that's buried in these books that I think is something we very much need in this particular moment.
It's interesting that you mentioned the death of Ivan Ilyich, because people often cite that as the first kind of modern fictional account of death. Books about dying and death are obviously nothing new. You also mentioned Sherwin Nuland's book, How We Die, which I think really, until this most recent wave, was kind of the last major book, obviously more modern and nonfiction than Tolstoy. But now recently, beginning with Atul Gawande's book, Being Mortal, there's just this wave. And I wonder if it is in part, as you said, we're searching for some kind of meaning in the absence of the religious aspect.
The irony, in a way, of working on this review is that it was of three books which are more broadly about the questions of death and dying, and then these two books, which are memoirs, Marion Coote's memoir of her husband's death, and Paul Kalanithi's memoir of his own death, finished off by his wife, Lucy. The books that were in the abstract about death, though some of them are very good and there was a lot of strong writing in them, remained in some ways relatively abstract and somewhat distanced from the actual experience. Atul Gawande's book is, of course, a remarkable book, but it is to some degree a scientific book. Now, Paul Kalanidhi was a doctor, so there's science in his book. Marion Coutts sort of just isn't going to be bothered with the biology of what's going on beyond the most basic sketching. But their books really say, in effect, okay, we spent a long time trying to figure out how to prevent death. What is preventative medicine? What is positive psychology? What are all of these things that can keep us alive and can keep a quality of life? And then there's a point at which you say, we can't keep alive, and the quality of life is in many ways descending, and what do we do? And that's such a huge question. And I think even the Gawande book and even Sherwin Nuland's book and even, you know, Susan Sontag's books before that and so on and so forth don't give that information fully. I don't know that it ever can be given fully, but I think insofar as it is given in its own time. And those books are from a while ago. And now suddenly there are these books and they say, this is where we are as a society and this is how one pulls through it.
I wonder if it's not only the fact that there is a less religious training for a preparation for death, but also that we used to, societally before the last century, know death more intimately because, you know, childbirth, you know, was often a deadly experience. Mortality was much, infant mortality was higher. People often experienced death more intimately before they themselves died. And now we seem, you know, almost surprised by it, taken aback, like in our kind of self-help culture in which you're constantly improving, the fact that at some point you start to deteriorate seems to kind of take us by surprise.
Yes, and of course, both Paul Kalanidhi and Marion Coutts' husband, Tom Lubbock, died untimely deaths. They were both much too young to be dying. So they make us think about that fact that mortality isn't just a weird thing that happens to people who can barely move anymore and are 103 and in assisted living. It's really about facing those demons. And part of what's wonderful in those books is, and I think I said this in the review, there is nothing self-pitying in them, but there is also nothing euphemistic about them. None of them says, you have to feel so sorry for me, I'm dying, it's the most terrible thing. You know, none of them is kind of manipulative. And yet, at the same time, there's a kind of honesty in them. And maybe it's an honesty that's possible only when you're dealing with birth and death. But it's not possible for most people. And the language that Marion Coutts uses is so beautiful and so nuanced. You know, there's the old cliche that you read certain kinds of news stories and you go home and hug your children. I would say reading these books, I thought differently not only about my own death, but about the death both of the people in the generation ahead of me and in the generation behind me and everyone else. And I thought, oh, I'm living more in reality than I have been, and I'm going to do a better job of loving because of the love that's in these books.
It's interesting that you mentioned that honesty and the love, because one of the decisions that I thought was very interesting that Paul Kalanidhi and his widow Lucy made in When Breath Becomes Air is to reveal in the early chapters, maybe even in the first chapter, that they were on the brink of possibly splitting up when this happens. And it really kind of set a tone for the rest of the book. You think to yourself, okay, they're not hiding anything in this book. They're not going to hide anything. There is no reason to hide anything. And it makes it all the more intimate.
Absolutely. And that passage in the book is immensely, immensely powerful. And in a similar vein, Marion Coutts' book is punctuated by the emails, group emails she sent out to her friends saying, this is what is happening and we need our friends. And you think even as they were living it, it's not that they're retrospectively honest. It's that they forced themselves into honesty in the present tense and sustained it.
I want to talk about the other books also. Two of them, as you said, are by hospice workers. And in a way, that kind of feels like a cultural follow-up to Being Mortal and similar books, looking at, you know, is it possible to have a good death? And what does that mean?
Well, Anne Neumann wonderfully comes toward the end of her book to the explanation that death is always tragic, death is always a loss. The most you can hope for is a good enough death. It's not as though there's information out there that will take the sting out of mortality. But I think that what they also say is, you know, plan for this. I mean, one of the books says rather wonderfully, if you're on a vacation and you're getting ready to go back home, the last two or three days of the vacation, you're thinking about how you want to get home and what you're going to do when you get there. And you sort of plan not only going away to someplace lovely, but also the return to a home that may be difficult. If you can do that when you've been in the Caribbean for a week, how can you not do it when you're looking at the end of your life? And they say, you know, wake up to this stuff. You think it's depressing. It's actually more depressing to be hiding from it. When I was working on my own book about depression, I was very much struck that the cornerstone of resilience was people's ability to face up to the reality of what was happening to them and to sustain a connection to what had happened to them rather than to go into a kind of denial. When you're in denial, the thing that you're hiding from looms ever larger and the denial occupies ever more energy. And all of these books, the memoirs and the philosophical ones, essentially say, stop it with all the denial. It's not making you happier. It's not protecting you. It's not protecting anyone else. It's making things worse.
So how then do you prepare for death? Do these books offer any insight? As you mentioned, two of them are intimate memoirs, and I kind of wonder, are those more effective at providing that insight than the three sort of more general nonfiction books are?
Yes, in a word. The memoirs are the most powerful of these books and are the ones that will stay with me forever. The others have a lot of useful information. They have some lovely writing. They have some real insight. I'm glad to have read them, and I think that they're helpful. But one set of books describes a phenomenon and the other to enact that phenomenon. And an enactment, I think, is always the most powerful way.
One final point that I think at least one of these books deals with is a kind of larger cultural shift. Funerals and death as an occasion for mourning to an occasion for commemoration. And I wonder what you make of that.
It's an interesting matter that there was a huge debate in the latest writing of the DSM, which is the Manual for Psychiatry, about whether you could have depression initiated by grief and whether people who had had a catastrophic loss should be on medication. It reflects a larger question about whether our objective is to achieve happiness or whether it's something else. And at what cost we insist over and over again on happiness.
Right. Is happiness health, or is experiencing the full range of emotion what is healthy?
Right. And is healthy more desirable than happy?
Right.
You say, I'd like my kids to be happy and healthy, and we do all we can to protect our children from anguish. We don't want our children to be miserable. That's pretty basic.
And yet it would be unhealthy not to grieve over a death.
Exactly. And one of the point that gets made is we tend to have these wonderful commemorations that are almost like weddings instead of funerals, in which we weep and beat our breasts and say, the loss of someone I love truly and deeply is the most terrible, desperate thing that's ever happened to me, and I find it unbearable. And that's become a kind of cultural tendency. You know, it's important to celebrate someone's life, but it's that thing of saying, I don't want to have a funeral. I just want everyone to come together and talk about all the great stuff that happened.
Play music.
Yeah. That's not reality. Reality is that life contains a lot of grief and a lot of pain. I think there is depression that's initiated by grief and requires treatment. But I think there are people who want to treat away the grief itself. And I think part of the reason these books are now having so much success is that we're at a moment at which that tendency is suddenly being questioned by a larger population. And people are smart to do it. And the argument of these books, in effect, is, you know, learn to cry and get started doing it ahead of time, and then it won't be such a disruption when it happened. But don't feel you have to close down to it. And the two memoirs are really monuments. I mean, Paul Kalanidhi's, in a way, a monument to himself, but Marion Coutts's, so movingly, I read it and I thought, in this sense, her husband, in his final nobility, lives forever. And that's part of what books do, is they make permanent things that are transient. And a book that fully achieves that has really accomplished the greatest goal of literature.
Well, I can provide no better ending than that, Andrew. Thank you so much.
Pamela, a pleasure every time. Thank you.
Andrew Solomon this week reviews 5 books about love and life and loss and death. The books are, again, Death's Summer Coat, What the History of Death and Dying Can Tell Us About Life and Living by Brandi Chalais, The Good at Death, An Exploration of Dying in America by Anne Neumann, In the Slender Margin, The Intimate Strangeness of Death and Dying by Eve Joseph, The Iceberg by Marianne Coutts, and When Breath Becomes Air by Paul Kalanithi. Andrew, thank you again.
Thank you.
Alexandra Alter joins us now with news from the literary world. Hi, Alexandra.
Hi, Pamela.
So we've got lots of exciting news.
Yes, a lot of it is coming out of the theater world this week. So there's a famous book that's being turned into a play, which is then again being published as a book. That's the Harry Potter series. And it was announced this week on J.K. Rowling's website that the play that's coming out in the summer will be published as well as a book. And it immediately shot to number one on Amazon. People are reacting as if this is like a new installment of the Harry Potter story, which she had to clarify. It's not exactly the story continuing.
It'll be like the best-selling play ever.
Exactly. I think more than Shakespeare, probably, since it's J.K. Rowling. You know, people are already excited about the play. This means you don't have to go to London to figure out what happens to Harry. The other big
but
news...
But you do have to stay up until midnight.
You always have to stay up until midnight with a new Harry Potter release. The other exciting theatrical news was To Kill a Mockingbird is coming to Broadway finally after almost 60 years. This is another surprise move for Harper Lee. She resisted selling the Broadway rights early on in her career and changed her mind lately. But it's Scott Rudin, the film and theater producer, who, as you know, is a big fan of literary novels and aggressively collects as many rights as he can to adapt works. And he has brought on Aaron Sorkin to write the script, which prompted a lot of commentary on Twitter about how quickly Scout and Atticus will be talking, whether their Southern drawls will become sort of machine gun fire dialogue like a typical Sorkin TV show.
It will be presented at a major press conference.
Exactly. They'll be rushing around the courtroom. You know, I think that's very significant for kind of the legacy of the novel. So far, you know, there have been kind of regional plays, a lot of school plays. There's an amateur production that goes on every year, famously in her hometown in Alabama, that's been going on for the past 26 years. But there's never been a Broadway production. There's never been like a large-scale theatrical reimagining of it. And I think particularly in the wake of all the controversy.
Yeah, who's going to be that racist Atticus Finch?
Exactly. No, that's a good question. I mean, this, you know, particularly after the publication of Ghost at a Watchman, people have had very conflicted feelings about Atticus Finch, who is this, you know, iconic literary figure who stood for justice, but in the second novel was not so perfect. So I think, you know, Scott Rudin and Aaron Sorkin were both clear in interviews with me that they are going with the old Atticus. This is from To Kill a Mockingbird. They're not kind of reimagining the figure in the wake of Harper Lee's other novel. But I think, you know, for readers that did wrestle with that and were disappointed by Ghost at a Watchman, you know, a new version of Atticus could be kind of a balm or reassuring.
I want to go back to the first story. Are we going to fly to London to go see the opening night of this play, Alexandra?
I think we should. I think we
have
should
to argue
on
that there's
list.
A case.
Exactly.
All right. Thanks, Alexandra.
Thanks for having me.
Alexandra Fuller joins us now. Alexandra is the author of many books, including most recently the memoir Leaving Before the Rains Come. But this week she reviews a novel for us by Olga Grushin called 40 Rooms. Alexandra, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
So let's first talk about the author, Olga Grushin. This is her third novel. Who is Olga Grushin?
She's Russian-born, and she now lives in the U.S., so in an odd sort of way, I think she really follows the trajectory of her character, who's also Russian-born and lives in the U.S., and I think those of us who are immigrants from, you know, another culture, which she is, which I am, are able to bring, I think, a fierce new lens to our adopted home.
That's interesting. Does it feel like an immigration novel?
You know, no, it doesn't. It feels like the novel of womanhood, of what it means to be adopted into this middle class white female world. And I think that was something that I really sort of was impressed by in this book, was that she unabashedly takes a very narrow view of what it is to be woman, and it is this very small chunk of a demographic, the very entitled, the very privileged. And then we see the ways in which a woman comes of age. I think I wrote in the review the way women come of ages, because mm-hmm. I think women come of age as a daughter, as a wife, as a mother, as a grandmother over the course of, you know, decades. I think those of us who've been mothers, those of us who've been wives, know intimately there's a handful of rooms that sort of hold the, you know, topography of your soul in a way.
It's when I first read the title and heard about the idea, I thought, oh, wow. So she has 40 bedrooms that she lives in. She's moved as many times as I have. But then I realized, obviously, that it's not just about the bedroom.
Right, right. It's about the kitchen. It's about the father's study, the mother's bedroom, the entryway, the nursery, the wardrobe. A lot of times you read a novel and it's got this kind of very heavy, stern authority, and you daren't mess with the narrative as you're reading it. She has a real sort of poet's touch. So she really has it's light. She says some profound, profound things. But there's plenty of room for the reader to get in there and wrestle with, well, what are the rooms of my life? And I found myself thinking, you know, the greenhouse. And this morning I was sort of joking that the vehicle is another one, the car,
mm-hmm.
you know, for American mothers. You know, but for a lot of women, it is the nursery, the kitchen, the bedroom, the pediatrician's office, you know, those sorts of places, depending on where you are in your life.
Why do you think, given that, you know, there are all these different identities that this character has and that every woman has in her life, that she's only in this novel referred to as Mrs. Caldwell by her husband's name?
I thought that was such a flashback to Virginia Woolf, to Mrs. Dalloway, you know, who's identified one step further. You know, we do know her as Clarissa, but this seemed to me like a very sort of Wolfian novel in that it's the minutiae, the way in which women at some point get to take stock of their lives, but in a very, it's such a compromised way when you've had children, because I think that there's this overwhelming sense that just having children should be in and of itself enough. And it's not for a lot of women. I mean, I love Doris Lessing's quote that she couldn't really stand having small. She said toddlers were the Himalayas of tedium, which I thought was incredibly, both very true. You know, when my kids were tiny, I was so bored by playing with them. I adored them, but sitting on the floor and playing with them endlessly nearly made me go crazy with boredom. But I did it, and I think that's what, you know. But we don't get to say these things. And
no, it's so funny because, you know, your children will always say, "Do you want to play?" And the honest answer is, actually, I don't want to play. I don't want to play.
I want to rub my feet. Right, right. And I think that taking stock, it's so heartbreaking. I think that's what ultimately made me want to give this book to young women. I mean, I think all women will get something out of it. I think men are going to be forced to read it by their partners. And for me, the demographic I wanted to give it to was my 22-year-old daughter, and say, yeah. And there's that wonderful line at the beginning that I quote in the review where she says something, you know, where the sort of bizarre godlike character says, you know, be careful when you when you come to a fork in the road, that you take the path less traveled, otherwise the path of least resistance will be chosen for you, which in a way is kind of motherhood. I mean, we're biologically programmed to have kids. And that's where I think the other genius is. She brings up these really uncomfortable things that are almost taboo for us to talk about, which is that you can't do it all. It's very difficult to do motherhood well as a career, as well as be an effective partner, as well as be a community member, as well as have a clean home. You know, one of those things is going to fall through the crack. Women, I think, live in a kind of chronic sense of not having done enough.
I'm assuming the title is also a Wolfian allusion to A Room of One's Own.
Don't you think? Yes. The language, that kind of poetic, ponderous, beautiful language is very Wolfian. I really think this is a classic. And I feel that because I think it's incredibly beautifully written. She's not tempted to have that the novel have some sort of easy resolution at the end. She doesn't give us an easy answer. This is what you should do. You should choose a career, or you should choose motherhood, or you should go off and have that affair. She doesn't give the reader a place to rest. I mean, I think she keeps us with our wings beating, hovering in the air, thinking, okay, which is my trajectory?
What about the number 40?
I love that, too. So in the book, I also love the way Grisham, by the way, she has ghosts and sort of mysterious figures show up, and to me it felt a little bit like a kind of Eastern Bloc magic realism, where she has these quite normal conversations with clearly dead people. But the ghost of the main character shows up and says, look, it's always been 40. It's 40 years, you know, the number of days that Jesus was in the desert. It's a biblical number, and it's the time that it takes for a woman or you know, for a baby to be grown. And so there's this sort of sense in which 40 is the length of time it can take for the human will to be tested. I'm sure it's deliberate, because nothing feels accidental in this novel, but women don't get mentioned in the sort of trial of 40, except accidentally as being, you know, the people who are pregnant for 40 weeks. And so there's this real way in which you ask yourself, yeah, what is the trial of a woman? If 40 is biblically the man's lot, you know, 40 days of rain, 40 years in the desert, 40, you know, 40 days and nights, Jesus. What is a woman's trial? And why is that not spoken about? And why do we not have women in the Bible really being put to the test spiritually the way men are over and over and over again? I think in this way, even though it would be hard to say that this protagonist is a feminist hero, the book is a wonderful feminist track.
There's this one quote that you quote this toward the end of your review that I love. She writes, I used to wonder, and this is the voice of Mrs. Caldwell, does it happen to others as well? Do their lives change bit by bit, a new table here, a new baby there, until one day they wake up and look around and recognize nothing of their past in their present? But I grew into it, learning to count my blessings, learning to appreciate the small things. In fact, the older I get, the more I suspect that what we mistake for small things are really the things that matter. And then you say that you're not sure that she quite believes that that's not necessarily her final answer, Olga Grushin's, that is.
Right, because I think this book really does lend... I think this book's going to be a fantastic book for book groups, because I think that you people are going to get heated about this, because we'll be defending our lives while reading this book. You know, we'll be defending our choices, I think. But I think that particularly for women who've gone through a divorce or who had a very different idea of what they were going to do with their careers, and then they had children that perhaps were very needy. I mean, you certainly come across that where you'll find mothers that had children who had special needs and became their full-time job, became their work. And would you recognize yourself then? I mean, that's not what you're thinking when you're 20, 24, 26, that, you know, I'm now going to spend my life as somebody else's caretaker. However deeply you love that person, however much you give yourself over to that, that's not what you had thought for yourself. And I think that, yeah, I think there's this real way in which gratitude has become the new catchword, that we are all supposed to feel a sense of gratitude. And I think gratitude's a wonderful way to embrace the world. It certainly eases makes things easier. But a piece of me wonders if people, you know, those of us who are being encouraged to feel gratitude, that isn't yet another way to keep us silent.
Mm-hmm.
And say, no, actually, no, I'm not grateful. This is not what I planned. Damn you. I had another vision for myself, another dream for myself, and that got subsumed by, you know, my partner's career, my husband's career, my children, and their needs. And before I knew it, yeah, I was just this mother. And there's this wonderful place also, the mother says at one point, Miss Cadwell's pregnant yet again, and the mother says, you know, children aren't just placeholders. And I just thought that sort of caught in my throat too.
You know, it's funny when you say the thing about gratitude. I think about that saying that I didn't exist when we were little. I don't think, but is very popular now, which is kind of like a vengeful teaching of gratitude. It's you get what you get, and you don't get upset. And it's kind of brutal. Really?
I haven't heard that. How horrible!
Every teacher will say that.
Well, what I love too about this book is that there's this very real way in which what we're telling our daughters is sort of a lie. I mean, they can't do it all. And we know that because we've tried it. We're the worn out ones, and at least I am in my late 40s going, you know, dear Lord, I'm worn out because I did try and do it all. And I think I've wised up now, and I'm certainly put my feet up more and have other people have a crack at it. You know, you try doing it. When we say to young women, yeah, you can be anything you want to be, the piece that we don't tell them is, and you're going to be going up against the existing system, the establishment. You know, we don't tell our daughters that. I mean, that is the honest truth. The establishment doesn't want women to change and to sort of take over and to be in positions of power, but the status quo is so comfortable where they are. So, you know, we should be grateful, and we can put a bumper sticker on our car, but we're not really actually supposed to change anything.
This will definitely lead to a good book club discussion
then.
And we've succeeded in not giving a single thing away of the plot, I don't think. So, Alexandra, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me. This was a really fun review to do.
Oh, good. Alexandra Fuller reviewed for us this week Olga Grushin's new novel, 40 Rooms. John Williams joins me now to talk about books and love. Hi, John.
About what?
It's Valentine's Day. We have a love and death issue. And so that means we get to talk about happy love and sad love. But we asked readers first for their thoughts.
We asked them two things. We asked them for the most romantic book they've ever read. And then we asked them what lessons they've learned about love from books and from reading. The question about romantic books we got actually, I would guess that we got more responses than we've gotten to any other question we've asked. So people have at the ready the books that they found the most romantic.
I think I also added that they could tell us about heartbreaking books as well. They didn't have to be heartwarming.
Right, exactly.
Okay.
It can be depressing love or uplifting love. Let's start with the real classics. Sierra Dean listed Pride and Prejudice, saying Now, Then, Forever. Vera Haranandani said Wuthering Heights, The Ultimate Forbidden Love, and Katherine Ahern listed Anna Karenina, Despite or Maybe Because of the Ending. So those are the sort of deep classics. Then we get to the multiple responses. At least three readers, and I think more, but Melissa Weber, Suzanne Kirk, and Jacqueline Baker all listed The Time Traveler's Wife by Audrey Niffenegger. And then the most responses, I think, were given to Gabriel Garcia Marquez's Love in the Time of Cholera. I saw that over and over and over again. And so I'll give a shout out to some of the listeners who listed that. Brendan Kennelly, Ashwina Priolker, Susanna Miraga, Marion Clark, G. Harrington, Paul Aguera, and Aaron Osborne. Like I said, there were a lot, and I think there were others.
I don't think anyone was making that like a write-in campaign, do you?
I don't think so. I think that one comes to mind for a lot of people. There was Colleen McCullough's The Thornbirds, which I remember both the book and the movie being a favorite of my mother and other people when I was a kid. Courtney Scheidel, Mrs. Bon Vivant, and Angelique all named The Thornbirds.
No coloring books.
No coloring books yet. I don't know if coloring books have gotten around to deep romances.
I got some responses too. Lagaya Michon, who also writes for The Times and reviews for us, named The Thousand Autumns of Jacob de Zoet by David Mitchell, and with a quote, "Our steps together is ended. and the last lines, she said. James B. Cain said, The End of the Affair by Graham Greene. Read and reread, it's a story I can't shake. And Audible by Colin Firth is extraordinary. So another appearance, if indirectly, from we Mr.
Got,
Darcy.
Exactly. We got a few more single responses from people. Carrie Larson listed Patricia Highsmith's The Price of Salt, which is actually the novel that the movie Carol was based on. And so she hoped that a lot of people were reading that this year because of the movie. Jamie Leifer listed Calvin Trillin's About Alice, which she called a beautiful memorial to a true life partner. We should all be so lucky.
Someone else here, Jenny Stern Alford, mentioned Fates and Furies, Wasted Love and Trust, Heartbreaking. Interestingly, I just got a very angry email from one of our readers saying that Fates and Furies wasted their time. So obviously, not everyone agrees. Julie Erdl suggested Eleanor and Park by Rainbow Rowell and Tender by Belinda McKeon. That one is just out. Also heard from Rachel Menes, who said to both Romantic and Broken Heart recently, A Little Life by Hanya Yanagihara. She is also an editor here at the Times. And she said, I think my heart broke and reformed every 15 pages. Mm. Someone else mentioned, Bob Mayo mentioned The Razor's Edge. And then Jane Eyre from Sandy MacDonald.
I saw a couple of Jane Eyres, too, and also a couple of Eleanor and Parks by Rainbow Rowell. We should also point out that our listeners can be smart and almost too smart. A reader named Jack Winkler asked, romantic in the sense of love or in the sense of classical romanticism? And I didn't answer, so he didn't come back with this.
How could you leave him on? How could you not answer his question, John?
Sorry, Jack, but I think the other answers make it clear that most people were taking it in the sense of love. The other question we asked, I thought, was tougher, obviously, to answer on Twitter, but we did get some nice responses. The question about what books have taught people about love. A reader named Jazz answered that they've taught that so far my dream partner is a beautiful work of fiction. Thank you, literature, for giving me high expectations. So they're still waiting to find the person.
I often think that heartbreak is better written than
experienced.
Yes.
Oh, that it's better written than
happiness. Romance. Yes.
Absolutely. Yes.
Yes.
I think that my favorite romantic books tend to not have the happiest endings. Mrs. Vandermeide wrote that a life without passion is no life at all. Thanks, Jeanette Winterson. Hashtag written on the body. Hashtag the passion. A reader named Contrary Reader says that they have taught to write my own romance. Brooding, tall, dark, and handsome men a la Darcy and Heathcliff do not a good relationship make. That's interesting.
And what sayeth you, John? What's the most romantic book you've ever read?
You know, I've been thinking about this, and it's a really hard question. I'm actually going to name a short story that's quite old, but I think it was in the mid-1990s when I was an even more impressionable reader than I am now, by a writer named Stuart Dybeck. And it's a story called We Didn't. And it's actually about an unconsummated relationship, but it sort of goes through the process of how they were together and how and why things didn't work out. But it's incredibly, I think, romantic despite that.
Excellent.
How about you?
I was going to wish you happy Valentine's Day before you could ask me. I like heartbreak and dark stories and you know, people weeping in the final pages. So.
Sure.
Well, I'll say this. Anna Karenina, I think, is a novel that when you're sort of young and you're single, you read it and you think that's incredibly romantic because, you know, infidelity and abandoning children aren't things that matter to you. And then, you know, you read it when you're older and you think that's terribly tragic. And then, you know, maybe after you're married for like 50 years, it becomes romantic again.
Right. It comes full circle. That's funny because romances, it's true. I think it depends on where the person is in their life when they're reading it. So they change over time.
Well, with that, happy Valentine's Day, wherever our listeners are in time.
Thanks, Pamela.
Thanks, John. Greg Coles is here now to talk about bestsellers. Hi, Greg.
Hi, Pamela.
What's new on the list this week?
Over in hardcover fiction, there are two new titles. They're both series novels. Down at number 6, Jonathan Kellerman continues his Alex Delaware series of crime novels. The 31st book in that series is called Breakdown, new at number 6. And then a new number 1 this week, J.D. Robb, who is really Nora Roberts, continues her In Death series. That's the kind of futuristic suspense romances featuring Eve Dallas of a futuristic New York police department. The title of this one is Brotherhood in Death, and it debuts at number one.
All right. What's in nonfiction?
Also, two new titles in nonfiction this week. Down at number 11, the National Public Radio host Diane Rehm, a really excellent longtime journalist and host of the Diane Rehm Show on NPR, has written a memoir called On My Own. It's partly, mostly a memoir of her husband's death of Parkinson's disease, but then it also talks about how she became involved in the whole right to die movement after that. And she's a strong advocate now for helping mortally ill people take their own lives. And then up.
God, all of this is very spot on for the love and death issue.
It is.
They knew what we were doing.
Less spot on up at number two, Adam Grant, who is a professor of management and I think maybe psychology at the Wharton School, has a book called Originals. Ironically, it's sort of a clone of Malcolm Gladwell's Outliers. Like Outliers, this book also looks at what leads people to rise above their peers and succeed in changing the world. For Gladwell and Outliers, he really emphasizes practice. It's the whole 10,000 hours idea. For Grant in Originals, he's really emphasizing kind of your passion, following your passion and not conforming to what other people in the field are doing.
Neither of these is the Incredibles model of like you're just born a superhero.
No, they both suggest that you could take your success into your own hands.
Excellent. All right, we can all go and do that. Let's just turn over to the children's bestsellers for a minute because there are two books that debut on the list this week, one on middle grade hardcover and one on young adult hardcover that I think are novels that are going to really be making news. And both are reviewed in the book review this week. One of them, the middle grade novel, is Pax by Sarah Pennypacker. And it's just one of those great animal stories. And this time the animal in question is a fox. And then Salt to the Sea by Ruta Sepetys is on the young adult hardcover. This is a book about the Red Army in 1945. And her first book, Between Shades of Gray, was one of my favorite young adult novels recently. Also an historical novel of World War II about Lithuanians under Stalin.
Not to be confused with 50 Shades of Grey.
No, but apparently it was confused, and that helped sales. And I think, you know, you can only be happy that it did. One interesting thing about Ruta Sepetys is at least that first novel was sold abroad as an adult novel, but here it was sold as young adult.
Oh, that's so interesting.
Did very well.
Unless I'm mistaken, my daughter is reading that book now, unless there's another.
That's just what she's telling you that she's reading, Greg.
Anyway, so yeah, Salt to the Sea, new on the young adult hardcover list at number two.
All right. Thanks so much, Greg.
Thanks, Pamela.
Remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. Our producer is Jocelyn Gonzalez, and you can always write to us at books@nytimes.com. Thanks for listening. For The New York Times, I'm Pamela Paul.